from the City of Angels near the Pacific Ocean. Good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later on tonight, the psychic world of Vince Jenna. Here's what's happening. Boy, Delta Airlines, they're really having a problem. I think they were hacked, but they say it's equipment failure. Delta flyers faced more delays, cancellations, more headaches, as the Atlanta-based airline struggled with its computer systems for the third straight day. More than 300 flights were canceled by the afternoon. In addition, 800 scrapped on Tuesday, 1,000 canceled Monday, hundreds of other flights delayed. It is a mess. They are blaming a piece of equipment at the airline's headquarters. I'm not sure. I think there's a hack there. WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange implied in an interview that a murdered Democratic National Committee staffer was the source of a trove of damaging emails that the rogue website posted just days before the party's convention. Speaking to a Dutch television program after earlier announcing a $20,000 reward for information leading to the arrest of Seth Rich's killer, Assange said the July 10th murder of Rich in Northwest Washington was an example of the risk leakers undertake. Craig Hewlett, of course, has been a speechwriter, special assistant projects for Congressman Jack Medcalf. Craig, I wanted to bring you in to talk about this bizarre story and some others related to this. What's your take on this?
Well, actually, there's been six suspicious deaths. There's not a lot of evidence to confirm that the Clintons are involved in anything, but there have been six, just in the last month, six suspicious deaths. It isn't just Sean Lucas or Victor Thorne or Seth Rich. It goes on and on. And if you followed the Clinton presidency and when he was in Arkansas, that haunted the Clintons even when they were in the governor's mansion. Vincent was
Foster.
Yeah, he wasn't even the most important one, I think, at the time. But I have to be honest with you. As I watch this, and I've watched what the FBI has done, the FBI is outraged that the FBI director dropped all charges and investigation into Hillary. The IRS is going to investigate the Clinton Foundation. Ties to the State Department and the Foundation have been exposed. Benghazi is back in the media again. And I don't think she's going to be charged with anything, no matter how much evidence there is. Because I believe, and this is just my opinion, George,
all right,
I believe Hillary has received a blanket pass on all indictments, trial, or even serious investigations, whether it's congressional or Department of Justice. I think she has already received a blanket pass to be elected president.
You might be right. Now, is there some possibility, Craig, that there's some sicko out there killing off all these people and trying to blame the Clintons or the Democrats?
That would take an exercise of such skill and magnitude, I would have to put it way down on the list. It was more likely that Hillary Clinton would have picked up the phone and done it, in my opinion. That would be just too difficult to achieve. And I've spent some time in the military, intel, and law enforcement work with different agencies to be able to say that pretty clearly. But I want your audience to understand something. When I say she's received a pass, it isn't because she's so beloved by the elite that they want to see her president. It is because if she receives a pass on all of these things she is actually guilty of, she will be absolutely under their control when she becomes president.
Interesting take. Craig, thank you. We've got to get you back for a couple hours at least. A former sanitation worker has been sentenced to death for murdering nine women and a teenage girl as the Grim Sleeper, a serial killer who preyed on prostitutes and drug addicts in the Los Angeles crime spree dating back three decades. We've got our own Jack the Ripper out here. The vast majority of head lice in the United States are now resistant to most over-the-counter treatments, meaning that it's now especially difficult to vanquish the tiny blood-sucking parasites, according to a new study. Now, as a parent, you understand what it's like to send your kid to school and they come home with head lice. Dr. Gary Ridenour with us. Gary, what makes the head lice so resistant to these types of treatments?
You and I have said this before. Nature will find a way.
Yep.
They have genetically mutated themselves. It's time to send the kids and the grandkids back to school, and there'll be 12 million cases for sure.
12 million. So with it being so resistant to these treatments, what do parents do? What do you do?
Well, first off, you know, you can try one of the over-the-counter ones like Red or a new one called LiceGuard. And if nothing happens, then the best thing to do is go to a physician. And there are three different chemicals that by prescription you can get that still will kill the head lice.
All right, my friend. Dr. Gary Ridenour. Doctors often tout how exercise can help ward off disease. But previous research has not concluded just how much physical activity is needed to reap those benefits as well. And to find out, researchers in the United States and Australia conducted an analysis of 174 studies published between 1980 and this year, examining the effect of exercise on five chronic diseases: breast cancer, colon cancer, diabetes, heart disease, and stroke. Study authors observed that to a certain point, the more a person exercised, the lower his or her risk of all five conditions. So just put that away. Up next, L.A. Marzulli joins me. Nephilim hybrids, that's what he's been working on. And wait till you hear what's next. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. L.A. Marzulli, author, lecturer, filmmaker, has penned at least 8 books, including the Nephilim trilogy. This could be number 9. Nephilim hybrids. And of course, he was just on with me just several weeks ago with Richard Shaw as we were talking about their Watcher series. L.A., welcome back.
Great to be here again, George. Thanks for having me on.
I knew you'd be coming back, but not this soon. But this book, it's out. It's ready to go.
It's ready to go, and we're really excited about it.
First of all, you've got to explain who the Nephilim are.
Well, you know, the backstory is, and I think we'll touch on it through the interview tonight, but there's an ancient prophetic text which sets up something which I believe has been carrying on for literally thousands of years, and it's this. And it's actually from the book of Genesis, first book found in the Torah. And it says, and here's the backstory there. You've got the God of the Bible, Adam and Eve, and you got the serpent. And the God of the Bible basically states something which is profound, and he says this: your seed, talking to the serpent, will be at war, at enmity with the seed of the woman. He will crush your head. You will bruise his heel. There's a prophetic narrative there, because the he that's talking about becomes Messiah. The seed of the woman eventually becomes Messiah. But the seed of the serpent, and this is what's so crucial about this passage, in my opinion, the seed of a serpent, three chapters later in Genesis 6, erupts. And what we read is something that's profound, profoundly disturbing. We hear that the sons of God, and in the Hebrew that's B'nai HaElohim, and you know, many people like Stephen Quayle have come on the show and talked about that. You know, most of your Coast followers know this, but for the new, you know, the newcomers, it's always good to go back. The sons of God are the fallen angels, and they see the women, and they desire them, and they take wives from whomever they want to. It's just whoever they want to, they take these women. They impregnate them, and the offspring is a hybrid being, part angelic, part human, which probably means, and I'm reading into the scripture here, that they have superhuman powers on some level.
Well, that tells me, number one, that they, the Nephilim, are physical beings. Mm-hmm. They aren't spiritual by any means, are they?
No, but they may have supernatural powers that mere mortals do not have. What's interesting is, apparently, one of the side effects was giantism, and they were men of renown. And what's interesting also is it says the Nephilim were on the earth in those days and also afterwards. And, of course, last time we were on with Richard Shaw, we were talking about, you know, our Watchers 10 movie, and it's also in the book, but the whole Afghan giant thing, which Steve Quayle broke right there, right here on Coast to Coast. And that was astounding, because we talked to the shooter, and then a third witness. So you've got Steve Quayle's pilot, who comes on the record, and you interviewed him on Coast. It's a riveting interview. People can go back in the archives and listen to that. Then you've got our shooter, which is one of the guys that shot this thing. And he says the thing was about 12 feet, absolutely humongous, six fingers, six toes, flaming red hair. He moved with an agility and speed that just defied him. I mean, he just looked at it and went, how can this guy move that quickly? But he did. And he impaled one of the soldiers, and they brought him down by shooting him. And there's probably 12 to 15 guys in this platoon. They shot him in the face. They basically blew his head off, is what they did. And down he went.
Where did the Nephilim come from? I mean, it's these aren't cases of angels coming from heaven. To me, it sounds like they're coming from a planetary system out there.
Well, and that's up for grabs, isn't it? Look, anything that's not from this planet is extraterrestrial. So if I say an angelic being, call it what you will, is an extraterrestrial, now people can say, oh my gosh. But in essence, that's exactly what it is. Anything off-world is an extraterrestrial, even if something that is off-world is interdimensional. And I believe what's happening is that these entities, wherever they're from, are interdimensional. You know, there's a whole, and I'm sure you know about this, there's a whole talk being bandied around on the internet that we live in a holographic universe.
Right.
I mean, if that's the case, then it's like, where are we really, and what is this really? And does that mean that we're it? That there's nothing else out there? And I don't know. But I mean, if we're in a holographic universe, then all bets are off. But it does explain some interesting facts. It explains the fact that when these so-called angelic beings come, they have the ability, the uncanny ability, to manipulate space, time, and matter, and energy in ways that human beings cannot do it. And so it appears like it's magic to us, but they just do it because it's who they are. It's what they can do. It's what they come in with, but they manipulate space, time, matter, and energy. And we read about this, we hear about this. So I lean to the interdimensional hypothesis rather than the extraterrestrial one. We're going lockstep together. We know that we're being visited. We know something is going on. There's a breeding program going on within the UFO community. Hybrids are being created. The Nephilim were real. They were on the Earth. The ancient structures that are all over the planet, from Gaza to Peru to, you know, Machu Picchu, I mean, wherever you want to go. I mean, this is, in my opinion, it's you can't duplicate these things today. You can't. Even with the modern technology that we have, you can't build a wall like what we see in Sacsayhuaman.
Isn't it amazing how when you read Genesis and just try to equate it to a real life event, it echoes it almost perfectly?
I agree. I mean, I'm right there with you. Something is going on, and all of this is really hidden from most people. Most, even in the churches, most people never get into this stuff. You know, they read about supernatural events in the Bible and the Torah, but when they're faced with something, like we showed that fairy, which, by the way, went viral, George. It's like got over 500,000 hits on YouTube. It's nuts. So, and this, of course, is the work of Jaime Masson, and Jaime allowed us to go with this, and someone, the 13-year-old kid, found it on the side of a road and brought it to Jaime, and we were down there 3 years ago filming Watcher 7, and Jaime, let us film, and we interviewed him, and we interviewed the geneticist, Ricardo Rangel, and they did DNA testing on this thing, and, I mean, we were taken aback by what we were seeing. And, I'll just spill the beans here because people need to know about it, and we talked about it in the last show, but we did the x-rays of this thing. Jaime sent us the x-rays. We were there when they took the creature out, got it x-rays, and we had no idea what we were looking at because there were all these little white dots placed asymmetrically in the body that showed up on the x-ray. We didn't know what it was. Well, I went to a veterinarian out here in an undisclosed location near where I live, and I sat with the vet, and he looked at the x-rays, and my first question to him, look, is this some kind of a hoax that somebody put this thing together from different animals? And he looked at it and said, you know, part of me wants to go there, but if it is, it's done so masterfully. I can see everything. Everything fits together perfectly. There's spaces where everything attaches to the pelvic girdle and the bones of the legs and the arms are hollow, which would make sense if something had to fly like that, and where the wings attach, there's more mass, and there's more bone, more muscle. So I said, well, what about these white dots? And he goes, oh, I've seen those before. And I go, what do you mean? He goes, they're BBs. And I went, what do you mean by BBs? And he goes, you know, like buckshot, like birdshot. And then the light bulb went off, and I went, oh my gosh, this thing was shot out of the sky. And that explains the broken bone that we see in the x-ray in the leg. I mean, you can see it. It's fractured.
Oh, it's bizarre. Now, the picture on the cover of the Nephilim hybrids, mm-hmm. that's the creature in
that's
a jar,
the
right?
That's the creature in the jar. There's a whole chapter. You know, look, Richard does an incredible job. So the book details some of that, and it's sort of behind the scenes from my POV. And then, of course, there's different chapters in the book which we don't cover at all in Watchers 10, but they're really meant to go together. But, I mean, we sat on this story for 3 years. We're still investigating it. It's amazing how people who have never seen it, never looked at the x-rays, but they think they know everything about it, and they don't know anything about it. I mean, look, we're not here trying to, you know, promote a hoax to people. We're not trying to do that. What we are trying to do is, what is this thing? And really,
and get to the bottom of it. Sure.
Exactly. And I was leaning towards hoax the whole time until I sat down with the vet. And once he said birdshot, then I went, okay, so this is birdshot. These aren't little drops of hot glue, which is holding this thing together.
And that matches the story of someone using a shotgun.
Exactly. Exactly.
Wow. We're going to get into the book at the last half of this this hour, L.A., and we'll take some calls with you next hour. But is it possible this creature, which has a face of a human, basically, doesn't it?
Sure it does.
Could it be some kind of an insect? I mean, if you look at a praying mantis, mm-hmm. it looks like a little man. And then, you know, so take a different creature that has more of a human look to it with wings. Could there be some kind of insect or species out there that we really haven't uncovered yet?
Look, anything's possible, and that's why more testing needs to be done on this thing. Since this thing went viral on YouTube, what was really interesting is I've had probably about 3 or 4 emails from different people who have had encounters with something very similar to what we show in the film and also in the book. One man went into his bathroom, flicked on the lights, and this thing was clutched to the screen on the outside, clinging to the screen, and of course he completely freaked out. Someone else saw something drive by their car fairly recently that looked very, very similar to what we show in the video. And the guy, you know, I questioned him, and the guy went, look, whatever this thing was, as I'm driving, it didn't fly horizontally like a bat or a bird would. It flew upright. Upright. In other words, the thing was standing and flying, and he was just, you know, am I really seeing what I think I'm seeing type of thing? So we've had some people that have emailed me telling their story, telling what they've seen, and that's what's so incredible about being on Coast and putting things on YouTube and getting the word out. All of a sudden, people start coming out of the woodwork, and they're not afraid of ridicule. They're not afraid to tell their story, and so we're getting some feedback on this, which is good. I think this thing is a hybrid. Now, I call it a Nephilim hybrid. The name of the book is Nephilim Hybrids, okay? So I'm not calling this thing a Nephilim hybrid. I don't know what it is. If I'm intellectually honest, I don't know what it is at this point. There's been no DNA testing that we've seen results of. We have seen the x-rays. It does seem to be real. The face looks human, pointed ears, teeth like a lion. The wings are there. It's got claws for hands. I mean, Jaime sent me a photo when he first got this thing, and on the hands, I mean, he's got real claws. It's got a stinger on the tail, which is very unnerving.
Yeah, it looks like it would attack you if it came flying by you.
It's not a happy looking creature. I mean,
And how tall is it?
About 9 inches, to 10 inches.
Can you imagine a swarm of them coming at you?
No, I can't. I not at all. And you know what's really strange, George, you know, Southern California, hummingbird people, we've all been around a hummingbird. But the first time I heard a hummingbird, I didn't know what it was. I was startled by it. And I'm looking around like, what is this thing? And like 6-7 feet away, there's a hummingbird. And I was just taken aback on how loud this thing was. Well, this thing's a lot bigger than a hummingbird, and the wings are larger. And we had someone that came on the record, she remains anonymous, in our very first Watchers film, and she talks about seeing these things in an undisclosed location, and she was just taken aback by how loud the noise of the wings were. And interestingly enough, the prophecies which talk about these things being released or something that, that might look like the fairy that we talked about, we're talking about now, it said the wings sounded like many horses.
L.A., when we come back, let's get into Nephilim hybrids. We're going to go through some specifics when we roll right back. Gosh, I was looking at the calendar with Tom, and our Asheville, North Carolina event is right around the corner. It's really coming up fast. So those of you who haven't jumped on board yet, do so. You can pick your tickets right online. Go to coasttocoastam.com, look for the picture of the Asheville, North Carolina event, and there we are. Click it, go into the theater's website, look for August 27th on the date, and that'll take you right there, and then pick your seats. There's 28 seats left on the bottom. That is it. And then the rest, everybody's up in the balcony. But there's good seats wherever you go. I was kidding last week when I said you needed a telescope up in the balcony. You really don't. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. L.A. Marzulli with us. We're talking about his work, Nephilim Hybrids. Talk about the Lovelock Cave handprint. What is that, L.A.?
Really fascinating story. The backstory on this is a friend of mine, Ron Moorhead. I know he's been on your show.
Yeah.
Talking, you know, he's a Sasquatch Bigfoot researcher, and he was called to a cave by another researcher. Now, the Lovelock Cave is in Lovelock, Nevada, and it was originally a site of the Paiute Indian tribe, First Nation people, Native Americans. I actually spoke with a Paiute Native American elder about the cave, one-on-one, which is incredible. I said, you know, can you tell me about the cave? And she's telling me this oral tradition, which has been handed down through the centuries. She talked about these large, very tall, very strong, red-headed giants that lived in the area that would take the women, take the children, and eat them, so they were cannibals. And what is now in front of the cave, it's a dry lake bed, but you go back 1,000 years, and there was water there. It was very lush and very verdant. The cave has been sealed off by the BLM. And originally, the cave went way back into the hillside. We'll never know how far back it really went because it's all sealed off. So when you go there, there's really not much to see. There's just a cave. The legend that was told to me by this Paiute elderess was this, that the tribe finally got tired of having been raided by these giants and these cannibals taking their children and eating them.
Jeez.
They had a war party, and they warred against the giants. And they basically gave them an ultimatum. Stop doing this, get right, or we're going to wipe you out. And, of course, the giants wouldn't do that. They retreated to what is now known as the Lovelock Cave, and they went deep into the cave. Interesting. It's always a cave, just like the Afghan giants.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, really interesting with that. And so the Paiutes took all this brush and put it in the mouth of the cave and piled it and piled it and piled it. And then they set it on fire. And as some of the giants would run out, they were shot. Interestingly enough, in the dry lake bed around the 20s and the 30s, 1920, 1930, I have the paper someplace to clip. I believe a 12-footer skeleton was found of a male and a 10-foot female. Very, very tall. And, of course, all that's hushed up. We have no idea where the remains might have been. Again, the BLM has gone in there and they sealed the cave off. An archaeologist, before they did that, archaeologists did go in, and I've got a book actually from the 20s, which is really interesting because it's, again, it's you got to kind of read between the lines, but there's hints of cannibalism, which ties back into the Paiute legend of the giants. Now, in that book, it doesn't talk about very large skeletons. But in one of the accounts, it talks about finding some 7-footers, which, again, isn't that large. It's not like the 9-footers I found out on Catalina, but it's pretty big. So fast forward to modernity, and Ron Moorhead, Joe Taylor, and I forget the other gentleman's name. Please forgive me. He's the guy, I think, that actually made the discovery. And when you go to the Lovelock Cave, there are no electric lights. There's no tour guide. It's just a cave, and it's essentially the mouth of a cave, because they sealed off both tunnels that would go deep into the mountain. Those are completely sealed off. So there's really nothing to see. There's a wooden platform there, and you look up above, and the ceiling is all blackened perhaps from a fire, which ties back into the oral tradition. And these guys were exploring around the walls of the cave. And one of the guys, and the picture's up on the Coast website, found this giant, what appeared to be a giant handprint on the wall. Well, these guys took pictures of this thing. They send it to me, and I made a beeline out there, but I arrived about 30 days after the fact. So we get to the site, we're all excited, we hike up this trail, there's no one around, and you can, by the way, when you're in the mouth of the cave, you can see for miles, literally. It's an amazing vantage point. Strategically, it would be a great place to defend and hole up, which is what, according to the Paiute tradition, the giants did. So we get there, we're all excited, the cameras are rolling, and we're moving around to the place where the handprint supposedly was. Now, before I tell you what happened, that picture of the handprint, and there's this gentleman holding a knife to give you an idea, like a Bowie knife,
yeah,
how big this handprint is. I mean, it's really large, about twice to three times the size of mine, and it's on the rock.
Clearly a giant's handprint.
Absolutely. And it's there, and he posted it on Facebook, mistake number one, and yeah. Unfortunately. So by the time we got there, and again, this is in the back recess of what is now the last remains of the cave, and you really got to be looking for it. There's no lights. You got to have flashlights, and you got to be looking for this thing. So we get there, and Ron and Joe are freaked out because they can't find it. And Joe goes, or Ron goes, one of them basically say, look, this is the rock. I know this is the rock. This is the place. It's not there. George, someone had come in and either chipped it off, washed it off with acid. The bottom line was it was completely obliterated. There wasn't a trace of it at
Vandals?
All.
Vandals?
Nothing at all.
I mean, do you think it was vandalized?
No, I don't think it was vandalized at all.
Suppression.
I think it was very deliberate by the powers that be. Of course, that's where I'm going to fall to, because that's what, having been out in Catalina and seeing everything else that they do, that's the way the game is played. And they didn't want this out there. The mistake these guys did was posting it on Facebook, and somehow it alerted the BLM or the powers that be. And, I mean, when we went to the rock, there was nothing there. I mean, why would a vandal do that? I mean, if you were a vandal, why not go there and take a bunch of pictures and post them on your Facebook page? Wasn't done. And this is in a really remote area. I mean, it's not like someplace you can just frolic to. I mean, it's in a very, very remote area, and it's hard to get to. It's on a dirt road, and you've got to hike up to the cave. And then you've got to know where it is. And without flashlights, I mean, yeah, you could find it if you know it's there. But if you're not looking for it, even with flashlights, it would be hard to find. And these guys discovered it. When we got there, completely obliterated. So what's interesting to me is that hand ties back into the Native American oral tradition. Is it conclusive? Of course it's not. But it's another step in the direction of verifying the Native American oral tradition that there were giants, very, very large people with six fingers and red hair that were in part of the indigenous population that were there and doing unspeakable things. And what I find interesting, the fact that they were cannibals ties right into the ancient Book of Enoch,
yep,
which was found in the Dead Sea Scrolls. So,
I mean, they do. They literally echo stories that we hear from what happened in the Middle East and in that area a long time ago.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's a definite connection between the two. Definite connection. It's not conclusive, but some of the DNA evidence, I think, that we uncover in the book and also in the film Watchers 10 points to that Middle Eastern European origin, and that's not supposed to be there.
Tell me about the ghost wolf.
There's a clip that's being shown on your site, and people can see it for themselves. This was taken at a Native American reservation in the Southwest. I spent time with this person and looked at this, at the original footage off the game trail, the original footage, and watched it before and afterwards. And this person who took it, this woman who took it, she's Navajo and born and raised on that reservation. And she set up game trails specifically because in these areas, because people were reporting strange things happening, going on at night. And so the whole purpose of the game trail being there was because there was something's going on, so she sets up the game trails to see if it's, you know, what's happening here. She calls it a ghost wolf. I think that's a misnomer. It kind of looks like a wolf, but what you see, and there's only a small clip that I was sent of this. The actual film is a little longer. You can see it at the very end. That's what I've got. But to the left of the film, which isn't in the particular clip that's up on the coast site, you see a Ford F1, you see a pickup truck. I don't know, I think it's a Ford, but you see a pickup truck. And this thing appears from nowhere. It's like a gateway, an opening, a doorway to another dimension opens up. And this thing that kind of looks like a wolf, but it's really, you know, that's what she's calling it. It's some sort of, in my opinion, a demonic manifestation. It jumps over the truck, hits the ground, and then it, in just a few bounds or whatever, it just leaps into the air and then disappears. And, you know, I've watched this thing frame by frame by frame. My good friend and the co-producer of the Watchers series, who's, you know, Mr. Photoshop himself, Richard Shaw, he examined it, and he thought it was the real deal. There was no evidence of Photoshop.
It would look very difficult to Photoshop that scene.
Pretty weird.
Yeah.
Definitely weird.
And it's short. It's like 11, 12 seconds
long.
Yeah,
it's just a very, very short clip. It goes in and out of the frame. And remember, the game trail is putting a frame up like every, well, you can set it for one every 3 seconds, a frame every second. I mean, you know, you can set the game trail like that, and that's how that works. What's interesting is on this reservation, there's all sorts of occult activity. I mean, all sorts of occult activity, and it's ongoing. Everything from multiple Bigfoot sightings to UFO sightings to very strange chimeras being sighted. It's all over the map.
And you can see that video at coasttocoastam.com. Lynn was kind enough to get it to us. It is amazing. Let's talk a little bit about skinwalkers. Skinwalkers, of course, a person who has got the ability to flip and turn into a shapeshift into an animal, for example. You've come across some of that in the book.
Not personally, and frankly, I don't want to for the obvious reasons. But I spoke to a man who had two encounters with it, and he has to remain anonymous. But I interviewed him, and he comes in on the record. That interview is verbatim in the book, Nephilim Hybrids. And look, I'm not calling a skinwalker a Nephilim hybrid. That's just a generic term I'm using because we're not sure exactly what we're looking at. But it all links back to the dark side. That's the point. It all links back to the dark side. And I remember speaking to one gentleman who was being trained to become a skinwalker. And in order to attain the power, you have to kill a family member. He came on the record and told me this. So here's the first of the two stories that this guy told me. He grew up on the reservation, Navajo reservation. And he and a bunch of buddies, like three or four guys, are walking in this one place. And he actually took me to the place. And it's sort of rolling hills with chaparral, cactus.
Mm-hmm.
It's semi-desert. I mean, it's the desert. And as they're walking, it's getting around dusk. And they hear this piercing scream coming from the other side of this small hill. So these guys run up to the top of the hill, and what meets their eye and is coming up towards them just completely freaks them out. Now, these guys grew up on the reservation, so they knew about skinwalkers. But this was the first time that this guy had ever seen anything like this. It had the body of a man, the thighs of a man, but from the knees down, the legs of a wolf, and from the neck up. And it wasn't a mask, George. It wasn't a mask. From the neck up, it was a wolf's head, basically what we would call a werewolf. And, of course, they were absolutely terrified. And they ran like crazy, and this thing chased them and followed them. And they got to this house and slammed the door. And this thing was, like, scratching and pounding on the door. And then some weird stuff happened, and the thing went away. That's the first encounter. The second encounter is, to me, incredible. And it shows, you know, a person that's schooled in spiritual warfare knows how to handle stuff like this. And this guy's father was a pastor, was a Native American who became a pastor, became a Christian, then became a pastor. And there was a skinwalker that was terrorizing this one family. And there were death threats on this family. So one night, now the kid's about 21. and he's at home with his father. The phone rings, and it's this family, and they're freaked out because the skinwalker is on the property, and they've seen it, and it's coming to kill them. That's what it's there to do. And so this pastor, without any hesitation, George, without any hesitation, he grabs his Bible and goes, "Let's go!" And they get in the pickup truck, he and his son, and they drive over to the house. And this guy is not timid. He jumps out of the car and goes, "Where is it?" And goes running at it. He goes running at it. And he's yelling at the top of his lungs, "In the name of Jesus." I mean, it's something right out of some novel someplace or some, you know, religious film. But the bottom line was, this thing retreated. And talking to the son, who at that time was 21, told me that they chased it into the brush, and it moved again so quickly and with such agility that it would move from like one place to the other place, and it was difficult to find, but they got it into this one place, and then it just sort of vanished. It just went away. And they saw the prints around the house. They saw the wolf prints around the house. So it was interesting to me, and look, I'm not trying to sound religious here, but this guy dealt with this stuff. You know, he dealt with it one-on-one. And that power in that name chased the thing out. And that, not his authority, but the authority of someone greater.
With all these things you've looked at, L.A., what does this tell you about what's happening here?
I think what's happening, George, I think that the veil that separates the unseen supernatural dimension from the natural world that we live in is getting very, very thin. I remember a few shows ago, we were talking about Black Eyed Kids on your show, and that was in Watchers 5, and we interviewed people like David Weberly, who was just
an expert on that,
incredible researcher. But we sat down with a woman, Leah Campin, who came on the record. She had an encounter with this thing, and Richard Shaw did a wonderful job reenacting that in Watchers 5, and it looked like something out of the X-Files, but these Black Eyed Kids are real. And I'm going to guess I get at least one a month, an email from first person account where someone has an encounter with it. There was a woman that just wrote me recently, like in the last 24 hours, her husband, who is no longer with her and passed away several years ago, she watched his eyes go completely black. And that's what she wrote me about. She saw or heard me talking about it, and she wrote me asking about, you know, what was this? What did I see? And this guy's eyes went completely black. And we've heard more, like I said, I get about one a month, roughly, from somebody that has an encounter. So something's going on. I think things are shifting. The fact that we've got that fairy that even though it's been a while since Jaime's had that thing, things are happening. Things are happening, and it's sort of unnerving.
Are other researchers taking note of all of this?
Well, yeah. Look, some of this stuff is met with a lot of skepticism, and I mean, I get that. For instance, our DNA evidence has been met with a lot of skepticism. Not a lot of skepticism, but some skepticism. And, you know, in the book, Nephilim Hybrids, I reproduce the letter, the complete report from a Lakehead University up in Canada, which talks about the DNA. And they had, George, you got to remember, they had no idea what they were looking at. They have no Nephilim dog in the hunt. All they're doing is they're taking a sample and they're testing it. That's it. That's all they're doing. They have no idea where it's coming from. We told them it's ancient DNA because we did a carbon-14 dating on it, and we know it's about 825, 850 years old. We know that. That's all we told them. So it's paleo, ancient DNA. And the DNA testing came back. The mitochondrial DNA was extracted. The mitochondrial DNA was then shown to be from the haplogroup, and that's from the mother's side of the family, T2B, which is Syria and Mesopotamia, which is, in my opinion, and that's a part of our hypotheses, I call that Nephilim Central, because that includes the area known as Mount Hermon, and the late David Flynn waxed eloquent about this, talked about the 200 watcher angels coming down in the days of Jared that we read about in the Book of Enoch, that's on Mount Hermon.
More to talk about with you, L.A., when we come back. We're going to talk about some DNA results, and we're going to take your phone calls, too, on Coast to Coast AM.